The Alliance for Insurance Reform has conducted a study of over 450 businesses and very notably voluntary and community groups, and their premiums have increased by 15% on average despite the introduction of new guidelines and regulations last April. To discuss this, I'm joined on the director by, on the line by Director of the Alliance for Insurance Reform, Peter Boland. Peter, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
This is deeply disappointing for all of those businesses, for all of those community and voluntary groups. Their cost prices are continuing to rise almost exponentially, and yet costs are plummeting for insurers.
Yeah, and you've got to go back to why all this started, Ciara. This has been a problem since about 2015, because the scale of insurance premiums forms an existential threat to many small businesses and to voluntary and community groups. And seeing as you've highlighted voluntary and community groups, what it's also doing in a very insidious sort of a way is stopping those groups from doing the very stuff that they were set up to do, very often with state grant aid. So that's at the heart of the problem. So it won't be solved until we get insurance premiums down. Now, the insurance industry have been talking for years about the mantra that claims drive insurance costs. And with that in mind, the government has done a considerable amount of work to date on getting the level of damages down, as highlighted by the Personal Injuries Assessment Board report from last week, which you covered, which brings claims down by 40% so far since the 24th of April. That's terrific. That's really good news. And on top of that, the actual total number of claims in the personal injuries area has been reducing gradually year on year for the last 11 years. And since 2009, the number of claims are down by 47%. So everything is set in order to reduce the risk, reduce the cost, and yet we're not seeing the insurers following through.
And it isn't the case, and I'm being flippant here in saying that the manner and tone of the accidents which have occurred, and I use the term accidents advisedly, have increased with such gravity as if the link between claims and premiums were to be as solid as insurers and commentators in that area would have us agree, to support the current and ongoing increase in premium prices.
Well, we're seeing reforms all over the place. So just on the ones in inverted commas, as you put it, the Garda Insurance Fraud Coordination Office has been established. There's a new statutory offence of perjury with the Perjury Act being commenced. It's all been taken very seriously now. Government is working on new legislation on rebalancing the duty of care, which is applicable in every premises you go into, which is another very big issue. There's talk of reform of PIAP, although we await the proposals in that area. So there's an awful lot happening, and it covers more or less every aspect of what might have an influence on insurance costs. And as I've, at the risk of repeating myself, that's not being reflected in the premiums.
And there is also a massive variance in the increase of premiums per sector. So your survey is indicating home care businesses hit by an average increase on renewal of 122%. That, I would imagine, for many of those firms is untenable. Nursing homes are seeing an average increase of renewal of 35%. Hospitality premiums are up another 9%, despite a significant drop in the level of activity at that sector since March of 2020. Members of the WHEAL, which is the umbrella group for charity and community organisations across the country, found 45% of respondents have seen increases of over 10% in their liability insurance. Taken in the round, that just seems like there will be an awful lot of businesses closing and an awful lot of charities, voluntary and community organisations shutting up shop, not because they're incapable, but because they cannot afford the premiums to enable them to go about their business.
Well, this is you've hit the nail on the head there. This has been an issue since 2015, and particularly during the pandemic, businesses that already had unsustainable insurance costs were still having to pay that premium when they were closed during the pandemic for fear of losing cover altogether. So, you know, if anything, any organisation that has been weakened by the insurance issue is in dire straits now at this stage. And so there is an enormous level of urgency about this. Government have already acknowledged that there's a lack of competition in the market, and they've established an insurance competition office with this in mind. That's terrific news, but it needs to work very, very quickly now. We need to get additional underwriting capacity into the market, and we need to ensure that the central bank, which has overall supervisory control in this area, fast tracks new underwriters through so that we're not waiting for approval for 6 to 12 months, as often happens.
And is competition the linchpin here? Because you've noted a huge number of areas in which reforms have taken place, in which works have begun, yet there are the same number or fewer insurers than, in the Irish market than there were 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, it would seem to be the common thread. And where you have healthy competition, if you look at motor insurance, it looks like from our figures, and they will be backed up by the CSO, renewals are down an average 10% since the new guidelines came in April. So there are quite a number of insurers competing for your business in the area of motor insurance. When we saw such big increases in some sectors, we went back across them individually and contacted many of the respondents. And the thread running the whole way through was, we only have one underwriter. We cannot get a second quote. And that's very often, even in letters from brokers explaining huge increases, they're regularly saying now that they could only get one quote.
Peter Boland, Director of the Alliance for Insurance Reform, thank you indeed for joining us. As you will have heard in our main lunchtime news, and again at our heads at 2 o'clock, nightclubs will be allowed to reopen from Friday with some caveats in place there. I'm joined on the line to discuss this by Agriculture Minister Charlie McConnellogue, who's visiting County Kildare this evening, and more on that anon. Minister, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
It seems that for most people it is very much as anticipated. Characterise for us today the Cabinet meeting earlier this morning.
Yeah, well, I think there was a lot of deliberation in relation to where we stand. Obviously, from the initial reopening plan at the start of September, the 22nd of October had been given as the date where we hope to probably reopen society. And certainly the first number of weeks, the figures were very positive and encouraging in relation to reducing infection levels. But obviously the last 2 or 3 weeks, that has become more challenging. But we didn't, as a government, engage very closely with public health professionals and with NPHET in the last week or two to try and set a platform which would try and keep everyone safe, but which would give us the best capacity we could to reopen, get back to more normal life. And I think the decision reached today is a measured one, and obviously it means that we can proceed with the full reopening in terms of capacity of all types of activity, including hospitality, entertainment, and the nighttime economy. But with people taking reasonable measures and precautions to keep themselves and others safe alongside that. And obviously the importance of the vaccination programme has been really important in relation to actually enabling that.
A lot of the measures will be very welcome, particularly for anybody who's planning to get married towards the latter part of the year. Caps on attendances at weddings and religious events are being lifted. Clubs, as you say, will be allowed to reopen on Friday, and the 11:30 closing time for pubs and restaurants is to be scrapped. Attendance limits for outdoor events have been lifted. So a grey area, Minister, if you might be able to clear it up for us. Some confusion about attendances at large indoor events, with the guidance saying everyone needs to be seated and events should be subject to sectoral guidelines, which may include social distancing. When can we expect to hear those sectoral guidelines?
I think there'll be further engagement now with the sectors in relation to clarifying that. But I think overall, the broad outline in terms of how we go forward has been announced today. Obviously, it's really important in each setting, and there will be a responsibility in every setting of life over the time ahead to do this as much as they can to stay safe. And obviously for those sectors that are due to reopen now on Friday, there will be further engagement with those around
and
how that will work.
Minister, is 3 working days sufficient to draft, adequately communicate those guidelines and ensure that those businesses are prepped to open on Friday evening if they're able to do so?
Yes, I think so. I think obviously, all of these businesses have you know, have been preparing for this for a long time. There's general advice there now in relation to the fact that capacities, you know, that we can work off a full capacity. The detail will be around how we take as many steps as we can in doing that to stay safe. So that engagement will happen now between public health and the various sectors to clarify that in the time ahead. And listen, I know it has been really challenging for everyone over the last number of weeks and months in terms of the different challenges and how things have moved at different times. And likewise, now as we move to full reopening, there remains those couple of issues to be clarified. But I think there will be very good engagement in the next couple of days in relation to bringing that about. And I think certainly overall, everyone will welcome the fact that we can do this. But at the same time, there is that, as has been the case up until now, everyone needs to remain conscious of the fact that the virus is still in circulation and taking personal responsibility for how we interact ourselves, and also then for the particular responsibilities on businesses to take the appropriate steps they can as well to keep everyone safe and customers safe.
Now, you'll be visiting us here in County Kildare this evening, of course, accompanied by Minister of State and Kildare South Fine Gael TD Martin Hayden. You're travelling to Kilcullen Mart. Why?
Yeah, well, I'm currently, along with Minister Hayden and Minister Pippa Hackett, finalising our CAP plan, which will serve us for the next 6 years. And we're finalising that between now and the end of next year. And obviously that CAP plan is what sets out the different schemes which will be available to farmers over the next number of years. And obviously those schemes are really important from the point of view of farmer income, and also really important in terms of actually delivering on producing high quality food and also delivering for the environment. So it's important that there's really good engagement with farmers who are those who will be participating in them and will have to deliver those schemes, and for whom those schemes are so important. So I've, over the last number of weeks, I've been travelling and visiting each county in the country to meet with farmers in each county, because each county is very much different in terms of its farming type and its the different challenges. So tonight at Kilcullen Mart, along with Minister Hayden, I look forward to meeting with farmers from across Kildare to discuss the development of that CAP programme, and particularly how we can make sure that it works well for them and delivers and is practical for them in terms of the schemes we put in place for the next number of years.
And that event starts at 7:30 this evening. Agriculture Minister Charlie McConnellogue, thank you indeed for your time this afternoon.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
I think we all know and understand at this stage of the pandemic how key ventilation is to putting a halt in the cough of transmission. And to that end, CO2 monitors have been delivered to schools across Ireland in quite a broad church of volumes. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Joe McKeown. He's president of the Irish National Teachers Organisation. Joe, you're welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm very glad to be here again.
Delighted to have you. Are the monitors that have been delivered to schools in which your members work, are they sufficient in number and quality?
Well, certainly they're not sufficient in number. We do think they have been delivered to almost all schools, but there are still one or two areas, schools that have not received them. But the quantities have been small. And I think one of the issues that we're coming across is that schools are finding that there are problems in the rooms. They're finding problems with ventilation, but then there's not a lot that they can do afterwards, and that even with windows and doors open. And we're also getting reports maybe of some inconsistencies in the reading between CO2 monitors. But look, we're glad to have them. But yeah, on their own, they're not sufficient to deal with the problem that's there in relation to ventilation. We have a lot of teachers saying, look, we have very overcrowded, stuffy rooms. We have the heat on now. Well, we're lucky enough it's mild at the moment. Mm. But, as temperatures are forecast to drop in the coming days, but we find the rooms are getting stuffier. And even with windows and doors open, once the heating comes on, we're having problems. So it certainly is an issue.
Just to go back for a moment, Joe, to those inconsistencies you mentioned between CO2 monitors in certain and limited settings. Could that be a calibration issue? Is there a fault with those monitors insofar as your members have been able to ascertain, given that they're not CO2 monitor experts?
Well, I suppose the issue is that we have been told that these were easy to use, so people turned them on. I mean, obviously, we don't know whether there's a fault in them, but just we have had issues where principals are saying, well, we've put two monitors on in one room and they give two different readings. So that kind of undermines the confidence in them over a period of time. But regardless of that, I think the biggest issue for most schools in relation to ventilation is that as the year has gone on, they're finding that it is more and more difficult to keep the rooms free of ventilation, the air free and circulating, particularly on days when the heat has to be turned on, and that's going to happen more often. So we do think maybe it's time to look at what other steps can be taken.
What, Joe, are you considering that those other steps could be?
Well, I suppose there's the issue of ventilation, but there are other issues that are even of more concern. In relation to ventilation, I think the department needs to indicate to schools that where there are problems, that they will look at having, you know, the various air filters that might actually address the problem. And I think there has to be a scheme or a plan put in place as to how that can be provided for schools that need them, now that we know that some schools will be able to assess their situation. But your listeners might be interested to know, Ciara, that the most significant thing that's happening at the moment in schools relates to the fact, as you know, we have a school that closed recently. But I was talking to a principal just in the last half hour who contacted the HSE last Saturday. They have a number of COVID cases in their school, and she's still awaiting a response from public health. And she has been advised not to notify anybody of the situation and notify any of the school population. And yet day on day, numbers seem to go up. And I think more than the ventilation right now, we need the public health risk assessment to be restored to primary schools at the earliest opportunity, because it's a really worrying situation.
And in any public health situation, 4 days waiting for some kind of word, whatever that word may be, is just simply too long.
It certainly is. I mean, what the principal urgently needs to know is, who should I tell? What should I say to the parents? Have we an outbreak in our school or have we not? And, you know, should public health do a risk assessment of my school? And waiting since Saturday, and you can imagine the sense of isolation and anxiety for a principal if every day you come in you hear there's another case, and you contact the HSE and you're told, no, you'll have to wait for public health to get back to you. And she's still waiting. It's just not acceptable, really, at this stage. And we said at the time, and I was on here with you saying at the time, back in September, that it was too soon to remove the contact tracing from primary schools. And I think at this stage, we'd all agree that that's the case and it really needs to be restored.
There's also the secondary issue of the way in which the HSE and Public Health are communicating with schools and what schools are permitted by Public Health and the HSE to communicate forward to stakeholders such as parents, such as staff.
Yes, and the very clear advice to principals is that they don't need to notify anybody in the school community if there is a case, unless public health advises them to do so. So I suppose I would put it to you that if you had somebody who stayed with you last night who was diagnosed with COVID and went home, and you had somebody else coming to visit you this evening, you might be inclined to tell the person coming to visit you this evening that you'd had a COVID case in your house last night.
I think it's not, but you might be inclined, you'd be eager to have them have the full set of information.
You would. And yet, in a school situation, a person can have COVID and the next day 20 people or 30 people can come into the classroom and not one of them will be told that there was a COVID case there yesterday, or that they were sitting beside somebody with COVID yesterday. I think most people would find that very, very difficult. And it's really, really important that public health get back to supporting schools on an ongoing basis, because principals are being left to deal with that situation on their own.
I mean, it's fairly clear, and I think government has stated words to this effect, that under no circumstances do they want widespread school closures as a result of COVID. But take the situation to which you alluded earlier at CBS Primary School in Wexford Town. 30 COVID cases detected there last week. Teachers have now pivoted to deliver online learning to students. That's for a very defined period of time. Yes, it is disruptive both to the learning environment and to the home lives of students, but surely that is preferable on a short and defined basis to the alternative.
Well, certainly. I mean, you know, the alternative is to allow COVID to spread through to more and more people and not to alert anybody to the fact that it is happening. And I think most principals, certainly, I think the key issue is we don't want to be sending children home or we don't want to be closing schools. And in order to keep schools open, we need public health people to be available to give clear public health advice, targeted advice for the school very, very quickly. And that's not happening. And in the absence of it, of course, schools and principals and boards of management looking at cases mounting up day on day are certainly going to feel a need to let their community know this is happening.
Joe McKeown, President of the INTO, thank you indeed for joining us this afternoon. We're being advised to very quickly get our Christmas ducks in a row. I'm joined on the line by Duncan Graham, Managing Director of Retail Excellence Ireland, who's going to tell us precisely why. Duncan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Ciara.
I know a lot of people are naturally quite organised for Christmas. I am not one of them. But you're saying get your skates on because supply and delivery of items could be an issue for some kinds of products.
Yes, and I probably would fall into the same camp as you, Ciara. And under normal circumstances, I would leave it to the last minute, as many, many people do across the country. And certainly, you know, we seem to have this conversation every year about buy early for Christmas. But, you know, the supply chain has been impacted throughout really the last 20 months of the pandemic. And, you know, what we're really seeing is a whole group of things that are coming together, which may well impact the availability of some products on the run into Christmas. So, you know, if you think about the fact that we've had periods of intense lockdown when demand has fallen through the floor, and then we've had recently the reopenings where demand has surged beyond expectations. You know, we've had COVID impacting manufacturing bases in the Far East, with factories being closed for periods of time. We've had COVID impacting big ports like Rotterdam. We've had COVID impacting ships that have been arriving at those ports and been unable to unload because of COVID and so forth on the ships. All of those things have all led to a situation where we've got a very volatile and unpredictable supply chain. And, you know, supply chain actually is something that, you know, under normal circumstances is very highly tuned. So all of these disruptions have meant that it's become extremely difficult to predict what will be available under the tree on Christmas Day.
And the supply chain, most of us are in the highly luxurious position of, in the general course of events, never giving it a second thought at all. And the kind of the risk with giving out this kind of advice, Duncan, because our reaction is quite natural. We want to get our loved ones lovely, thoughtful gifts for Christmas, is that people will rush out and try and buy everything. Now, it isn't that there's a shortage particularly of items. It may be that some items are in short supply, but in general, there is supply. It's just getting it here might take longer.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we're seeing. It's really twofold. One is that things that normally would take, you know, let's call it 6 or 8 weeks to come across from the Far East are taking a lot longer. So the lead time on product arriving into the country is a lot longer than it would normally be. And then the danger of this in the sort of longer term is that inevitably these things are resulting in increased prices. So if you look at, you know, bringing a container in from the Far East 2 years ago, the cost of bringing that container in now is about 4 or 5 times higher than it was in 2019. So it's a significant cost. Now, in terms of, you know, what that means to the consumers, there is absolutely no doubt that there will be product available. But, you know, things that are normally fast under normal circumstances, if you get a product in around now, let's say, and a retailer finds it's selling out of it really, really quickly, then many of them have got the opportunity to go back and reorder that product and probably get it in before Christmas and have another bite of the cherry. So fast-selling items sometimes sell out a little bit before Christmas and are then replenished. The issue we've got now is that because this supply chain has been lengthened and because there are these issues, getting that product back in is going to prove to be difficult. So, you know, things that are in a fast now will be in short supply as we head towards Christmas. That means there's still going to be an alternative. It just means from a consumer perspective, you may not be able to get little Jimmy the present that you wanted to buy him. You know, first off, you might have to go for something else. You know, I think the message is if you see it, buy it, because it may not be there the next time you go into that shop.
And then I suppose that might push us or refocus us to buying Irish insofar as is humanly possible, because the supply chain within the country is solid.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a number of retailers I'm talking to at the moment who have kind of anticipated some of this and gone, let's get product in earlier. So they've said, look, there's lengthening supply chain issues. Let's get those products in. Let's buy them in, you know, in bulk and get them into the country, which is partly why you've seen, you know, Christmas appearing in many retail outlets in sort of August and September. It's because the product's been there. And actually, you know, reality is that some people will buy it at that point. So, you know, you've seen some of that happening. But coming back to your Irish supply base, absolutely. What does this mean long term? Well, it means that retailers are probably going to be starting to buy much more locally, much more closer to home. And by closer to home, I don't just mean buying within the country. I mean buying within Europe and sourcing a lot closer to home than perhaps they would have done in the past. So we are going to see this shift taking place, not necessarily for this Christmas, but I certainly think you're going to start to see it happening more as we go through next year. And of course, that's good for everybody. And it's good for the climate. It's good for sustainability and all of those things. So, you know, there's a double-edged sword here.
And have you finished off your list and already begun your shopping?
I would have to confess, so I am still behind the curve myself. No, I mean, look, literally, we've been dealing with all these COVID restrictions all year, so it's not the first thing that's come to my attention, but it certainly will be trying to get the Christmas list started in November.
You and me both. Duncan Graham, Managing Director of Retail Excellence Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. Duncan was saying that there's a lot of shops that have their Christmas displays up already. I must be walking around in a daze. I haven't seen one. I do know that the Christmas stores in a couple of the more notable, bigger department stores in Dublin opened in August, but I think they do anyway. Have you seen shops going? And Kira tells me Whitewater is kitted out as well. Some of the stores there, that it feels so early. But have you got your Christmas shopping already done and dusted? Are you ahead of that curve Duncan Graham was referring to? 0833 97 97 97. Now I'm joined on the line by Robbie Kitt. He's a DJ and spokesperson for the Give Us the Night campaign. Robbie, you're welcome to the programme.
Hi, thanks for having me, Kira.
Delighted to do so. Are you any the wiser now than you were yesterday?
Somewhat. There still seems to remain many unanswered questions. There's a lot of confusion as to the difference between, you know, pub venues and live music venues and nightclubs in relation to seated requirements, distancing requirements indoors in relation to the entry requirements. So, unfortunately, we're not in a position of real clarity yet. There's been obviously word that there's going to be further clarification through the week, but it is just really unfortunate that we're having these conversations just days before the restrictions are lifted, rather than in a kind of a more advanced way. I'm planning for this in a kind of a more practical way. It just seems like this is a bit reactive and quite sudden, sadly.
Agriculture Minister Charlie McConnellogue was on with me earlier in the programme, and I raised the point with him that did he think, you know, 3 working days effectively was sufficient time for a business to prepare to reopen businesses, you know, involving rostering, engagement with suppliers, prepping their premises. He seemed to think yes. Now, I am not in business, but I would imagine in all probability it's not enough time.
Yeah, well, I can just take a pure practicality that there's been events organised and tickets sold for those events. So if there's going to be restrictions put in terms of the capacity of these events at such short notice, how do these venues go about distributing 60% of tickets?
Robbie, if you could just wriggle around a little bit. Your line is dropping out and we want to be able to hear what you're saying to us.
Yeah, absolutely. But like, just in relation to capacity for venues, you know, it's an issue where they've already sold like 100% of tickets. They've sold out gigs that have already been, sold this weekend. So we're in a situation where I don't really understand how those venues can actually go about distributing tickets to maybe 60% capacity if that's what's being muted. There's a lot of practicalities that really can't really be addressed in this such a short time frame. And the fortunate thing for us, I suppose, is that we've been stressing to the government that there's like methods in which they can actually describe to, you know, reduce the risk in these spaces. For us, testing, I think, is central to that. Antigen testing has been decried by NIAC, and I think the communication around that has been really terrible. I think antigen testing should be a part of how we actually go about operating venues and events safely going forward. It seems to me to be the only practical way. It's a system that's being rolled out across Europe. If we're only to look at the UK, where these antigen tests are available for free and widely available to the public, that's the kind of system that we would love to see being instantiated in Ireland. But unfortunately, that type of system can't really be put into place in 3 days. And these are things we've been saying to the government for months now. So it's been really frustrating not to be heard on these kind of practical solutions. And that's kind of where we find ourselves today.
And also at this late stage, I know Kildare North TD and Social Democrats co-leader Catherine Murphy raised this in the Dáil about 20 minutes ago. She says the announcement today was full of confusion, incoherence and chaos, particularly as it pertains to the nighttime economy, and says it's mad you can't get a drink at a bar in a nightclub. She says you could dance to the bar to get around the regulations. And this is the thing. Who goes to, you know, a club to sit there sedately, you know, with their hands clasped in their laps? Nobody.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that one of the biggest issues here that we've been facing is that there's been no direct consultation between health bodies, health advisory, and people who actually run these events. We've been dealing with these kind of conversations through the media, and there's been no direct consultation between, you know, entertainment venues and public health services. This is something that we've been repeatedly requested by the entertainment sector, again, for the last few months. And when we find ourselves in a situation where these decisions are being made without that advice, it's very obvious that you end up in a situation.
I think Robbie might be gone, but I think his point was clear and well made. That sectoral advice that we have heard so frequently to be given out to specific sectors before we move to a new phase of reopening, again at this juncture, coming very, very late in the day. And I know you heard Agriculture Minister Charlie McConnell earlier in the programme saying that he was of the view that 3 working days was enough time to formulate and communicate that information to the specific sector and have them absorb and react to it. Robbie seems to be of the view that it's not enough, particularly when they have been calling for that for some significant time.